Confess Fletch by Gregory MacDonald. Copyright 1976 by the author. This recording of the reading of Confess Fletch was published by arrangement with Gregory MacDonald and was produced in 1988 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape, Incorporated. Please observe the following procedures as you listen to these tapes. You may keep your book for 30 days from date of receipt by you, but after that time, we charge additional rental of 25 cents per day. Dates are checked by postmark. Please return this book at the earliest possible time so another subscriber can have the use of this recording. To return cassettes to us, simply make sure they are all packaged in their plastic cassette cases and in proper order in the mailing container. Kindly seal the mailing container for return. Postage is already paid. Drop in any mailbox for return to Books on Tape. Unless you are at home during the day, you will probably find it more convenient to have tapes mailed to you at your business address rather than your home. Reason is that postmen cannot leave packages if no one is there to receive them. Should a cassette fail to play properly, hold it flat in the palm of your hand and slap it smartly against a hard, flat surface. If this does not work, or if you cannot otherwise free the reels, call us at our regular customer service number. Give us the name of the book and number of the cassette. We will immediately send you a replacement at no charge. Discard the broken cassette. Confess Fletch by Gregory MacDonald. This book consists of 39 chapters and is 270 pages long. The following material appears on the dust jacket of the book. Irwin Fletcher, a.k.a. Peter Fletcher, or whatever name might prove convenient. Back from Europe with another promise of marriage, a mysterious death, and a fortune in lost paintings behind him. What appears to be a simple apartment swap turns into a web of intrigue when Fletch finds the flat overdecorated with a beautiful corpse. All the evidence points out that only one person could have committed the crime, and Fletch doesn't think he did it. The police think differently, though, and if Fletch won't confess, he'll need to find the murderer himself. Dedication. To Judy and Lou, Susie and Chuck, Stuart, Karen and Rupert, Jeanette and Alan, Ho-Ro, Ho-Ho, Susie, Chris, and Doug. Chapter 1. Fletch snapped on the light and looked into the den. Except for the long windows and the area over the desk, the walls were lined with books. There were two red leather wing chairs in the room, a small divan, and a coffee table. On the little desk was a black telephone. Fletch dialed O. "Get me the police, please." "Is this an emergency?" "Not at the moment." The painting over the desk was a Ford Madox Brown, a country couple wrapped against the wind. "Then please dial 555-7523. "Thank you." He did so.
"Sergeant McAuliffe speaking."
"Sergeant, this is Mr. Fletcher, 152 Beacon Street, apartment 6B.
"Yes, sir."
"There's a murdered girl in my living room."
"A what girl?"
"Murdered." Naked, her breasts and hips full, her stomach lean, she lay on her back between the coffee table and the divan. Her head was on the hardwood floor in the space between the carpet and the fireplace. Her face, whiter than the areas kept from the sun by her bikini, eyes staring, looked as if she were about to complain of some minor discomfort, such as, "Move your arm, will you?" or "Your watch band is scratching me."
"Murdered," Fletch repeated.
There was a raw spot behind the girl's left ear. It had had time to neither swell nor bleed. There was just a gully with slim blood streaks running along it. Her hair streamed away from it as if to escape.
"This is the police business phone."
"Isn't murder police business?"
"You're supposed to call emergency with a murder."
"I think the emergency is over."
"I mean, I don't even have a tape recorder on this phone."
"So talk to your boss. Make a recommendation."
"Is this some kind of joke?"
"No, it isn't."
"No one's ever called police business phone to report a murder. Who is this?"
"Look, would you take a message? 152 Beacon Street, apartment 6B. Murder. The name is Fletcher."
"Would you write that down?"
"156 Beacon Street?"
"152 Beacon Street, 6B. Through the den door, Fletcher's eyes passed over his empty suitcases standing in the hall. Apartment is in the name of Connors. Your name is Fletcher? With an F. Let Homicide know, will you? They'll be interested. Chapter 2. Fletch looked at his watch. It was 21 minutes to 10. Instinctively, he timed the swiftness of the police. He returned to the living room and mixed himself a scotch and water at the sideboard. He would not bother with ice. He concentrated on opening the scotch bottle, making more of a job of it than was necessary. He did not look in the direction of the girl. She was beautiful, she was dead, and he had seen enough of her. Sloshing the drink in his glass as he walked, he went back into the den and turned on all the lights. He stood at the desk, looking closely at the brown. The cottage behind the country couple was just slightly tilted in its landscape, as if it too were being affected by the wind. Fletch had seen similar browns, but never even a reproduction of this painting. The phone made him jump. Some of his drink splashed onto the desk blotter. He placed his glass on the blotter and his handkerchief over the stains before answering.
Mr. Fletcher?
Yes?
Ah, good, you did arrive. Welcome to Boston.
Thank you. Who is this?
Ronald Horan, Horan Gallery. I tried to get you earlier.
I went out to dinner.
Your letter mentioned you'd be staying in Bart Connors' apartment. We did some restoration work for him a year or two ago.
It's very good of you to call, Mr. Horan.
Well, I'm very excited by this Picasso you mentioned in your letter. You said it's called Vino Viola Mademoiselle?
It's been called that. God knows how Picasso thought of it.
Of course, I'm puzzled why you came all the way from Rome to Boston to engage me as your broker.
There's some evidence the painting is in this part of the world, possibly even in Boston.
I see. Still, I expect we could have handled it by correspondence.
As I wrote in my letter, there may be one or two other matters I'd like to consult you about.
Yes, of course. Anything to be of service. Perhaps I should start by warning you that this painting might not exist.
It exists.
I've looked it up and there is no record of it anywhere that I can find.
I have a photograph of it.
Very possibly it does exist. There are a great many Picassos in existence which have never been recorded. On the other hand, the body of Picasso's work very often has been victim to fakes. I'm sure you know his work has been counterfeited more than the work of anyone else in history.
I do know, yes.
Well, I wouldn't be giving you professional service if I didn't bring these matters up to you. If such a painting exists and it's authentic, I'll do everything I can to find it for you and arrange for the purchase.
Rotating blue lights from the roofs of police cars, stories below began to flash against the long light window curtains. There had been no sound of sirens.
Are you free to come by tomorrow morning, Mr. Fletcher?
Fletch said, I'm not sure.
I was thinking of 10:30.
10:30 will be fine, if I'm free at all.
Good. You have my address.
Yes.
Let's see, you're on Beacon Street across from the gardens, right?
I think so. Fletch pushed the curtains aside. There were three police cars in the street. Across the street was an iron railing. The darkness beyond had to be a park.
Then what you do is this. Leave your apartment and turn right, that is east, and go to the end of the gardens. Then turn left on Arlington Street, that is away from the river. Newbury Street will be the third block on your right. The gallery is about 2.5 blocks down the street.
Thank you, I've got it.
I'll send someone down to open the door to you at 10:30 precisely. We're not a walk-in gallery, you know.
I wouldn't think so. I'm sorry, Mr. Horan, I think there's someone at my door.
Quite all right. I look forward to seeing you in the morning.
Fletch hung up. The door buzzer sounded. It was 7 minutes to 10. Chapter 3.
My name's Flynn, Inspector Flynn.
The man in the well-cut, three-piece brown tweed suit filled the den doorway. His chest and shoulders were enormous, his brown hair full and curly. Between these two masses of overblown brown was a face so small it had the cherubic quality of an 8-year-old boy or a dwarf. Even with the hair, his head was small in proportion to his body, like a tiny, innocent-looking knob in control of a huge, powerful machine. Nothing indoors had the precise color of his green eyes. It was the bright, sparkling green of sunlight on a wet spring meadow. Below the break of his right trouser leg were a half dozen dots of blood.
Pardon my pants. I'm fresh from an axe murder. For such a huge chest cavity, for anyone, for that matter, his voice was incredibly soft and gentle. Fletch said, "You're an Irish cop."
"I am that."
"I'm sorry," Fletch stood up. "I meant nothing derogatory by that." Flynn said, "Neither did I." There was no proffer to shake hands. As Flynn vacated the doorway, a younger and shorter man came in, carrying a notepad and ballpoint pen. He had the grizzled head of someone fried on a Marine Corps drill ground a score of times, like a drill sergeant. The rubbery skin around his eyes and mouth suggested his eagerness to shove his face in yours, tighten his skin, and shout encouraging obscenities up your nose. In repose, the slack skin gave him the appearance of a petulant basset. His suit and shirt were cheap, ill-fitting, but spotless, and his shoes, even this late on a drizzly day, gleamed.
"This is Grover," said Flynn. "The department doesn't trust me to do my own parking."
He settled himself in a red leather chair. Fletch sat down again. It was 10:26. He remained waiting in the den. A young uniformed policeman waited with him, standing at parade rest, carefully keeping his eyes averted from Fletch. Beyond the den, other police, plainclothesmen, moved around the apartment. Fletch wondered if any reporters had sneaked in with them. Fletch heard the murmur of their voices, but caught nothing of what they said. Occasionally, a streak of light from a camera flash bulb crossed the hall, from either the left, where the bedrooms were, or the right, where the living room was. An ambulance crew entered, rolling a folded stretcher across the hall toward the living room.
"Close the door, will you, Grover? Then make yourself comfortable at the wee desk there. We don't want to miss a word of what this boyo in the exquisite English tailoring has to say."
The uniformed policeman went through the door as Grover closed it.
"Has anyone read you your rights?" Flynn asked.
The first fuzz through the door.
"Fuzz, is it?"
Fletch said, "Fuzz."
"In more human language," Flynn continued, "I ask you if you don't think you'd be wiser to have your lawyer present while we question you."
"I don't think so,"
Flynn said. "What did you hit her with?"
Fletch could not prevent mild surprise, mild humor appearing in his face. He said nothing.
"All right, then."
Flynn settled more comfortably in his chair.
"Your name is Fletcher."
"Peter Fletcher," Fletch said.
"And who is Connors?"
"He owns this apartment. I'm borrowing it from him. He's in Italy." Flynn leaned forward in his chair.
"Do I take it you're not going to confess immediately to this crime?"
He used his voice like an instrument, a very soft woodland instrument. "I'm not going to confess to this crime at all."
"And why not?"
"Because I didn't do it."
"The man says he didn't do it, Grover. Have you written that down?"
"Sitting here," Fletch said, "I've been rehearsing what I might tell you."
"I'm sure you have."
Elbows on chair arms, massive shoulders hunched, Flynn folded his hands in his lap.
"All right, Mr. Fletcher. Suppose you recite to us your opening prevarication."
The green eyes clamped on Fletch's face as if to absorb with full credulity every word. "I arrived from Rome this afternoon, came here to the apartment, changed my clothes, went out to dinner, came back and found the body."
"This is a dandy, Grover. Let me see if I've got it in all its pristine wonder. Mr. Fletcher, you say you fly into a strange city, go to an apartment you're borrowing, and first night there you find a gorgeous naked girl you've never seen before in your life, murdered on the living room rug. Is that your story in short form?"
"Yes."
"Well, now, if that doesn't beat the belly of a fish. I trust you got every word, Grover, however few of them there were."
Fletch said, "I thought it might help us all get to bed earlier."
"Get to bed," he says. "Now, Grover, here's a man who's had a full day. Would you mind terribly if I led the conversation for a while now?"
"Go ahead," Fletch said. Looking at his watch, Flynn said,
"It's been a near regular custom I've had with my wife since we were married 16 years ago, to get me home by 2 o'clock feeding, so we have that much time."
He glanced at the glass of scotch and water Grover had moved to the edge of the desk blotter.
"First, I must ask you how much you've had to drink tonight."
"I've had whatever's gone from that glass, Inspector. An ounce of whiskey, less?" Fletch asked, "You really have inspectors in Boston, huh?"
"There is one, me."
"Good grief."
"I'd say that's a most precise definition. I'm greatly taken with it myself, and I'm sure Grover is. An inspector of Boston police as being good grief. The man has his humor, Grover. However, we were speaking of the man's drinking. How much did you have to drink at dinner?"
"A split, a half bottle of wine."
"He'll even define split for us, Grover. A remarkably definitive man. You had nothing to drink before dinner?"
"Nothing. I was eating alone."
"And you're going to tell me you had nothing to drink on the airplane, all the way across the Mediterranean Sea and then the full girth of the Atlantic Ocean. Water, water everywhere."
"I had coffee after we took off. A soft drink with lunch or whatever it was they served. Coffee afterwards."
"Were you traveling first class?"
"Yes."
"The drinks are free in first class, I've heard."
"I had nothing to drink on the airplane or before boarding the airplane. I had nothing to drink at the airport, nothing here, wine at the restaurant, and this half glass while I've been waiting for you."
"Grover, would you make a note that, in my opinion, Mr. Fletcher is entirely sober?"
"Would you like a drink, Inspector?" Fletch asked.
"Ach, no. I never touched the dirty stuff. The once I had it the night after being a student in Dublin, it gave me a terrible headache. I woke up the next morning dead. The thing is, this crime of passion would be much easier to understand if you had a bottle or two of the old juice within you."
"You may find that is so," Fletch said, "when you find the murderer."
"Are you a married man yourself, Mr. Fletcher?"
"I'm engaged."
"To be married?"
"I expect to be married, yes."
"And what is the name of this young lady whose luck at the moment is very much in question?"
"Andy."
"Now, why didn't I guess that myself? Write down Andrew, Grover."
"Angela. Angela De Grassi. She's in Italy."
"She's in Italy too, Grover. Everyone's in Italy except he who has just come from there. Make a social note. She didn't come with you due to her prejudice against the Boston weather?"
"There are some family problems she has to straighten out."
"And what would the nature of such problems be?"
"I attended her father's funeral yesterday, Inspector."
"Ah, dicey time to leave your true love's side."
"She should be coming over in a few days."
"I see. And what is it you do for a living?"
"I write on art."
"You're an art critic."
"I don't like the words art critic. I write on the arts."
"You must make a fortune at it, Mr. Fletcher. First-class air tickets, this lavish, opulent apartment, the clothes you're wearing."
"I have some money of my own."
"I see. Having money of your own opens up a great many careers which otherwise might be considered marginal. By the way, what is that painting over the desk? You can't see it from where you are."
"It's a Ford Madox Brown."
"It's entirely my style of work."
19th century English."
"Well, that's one thing I'm not, is 19th century English. And who with a touch of humanity in him would be?"
"When did you notice it yourself? The painting, I mean."
"When I was calling the police."
"You mean to say, while you were calling the police to report a murder, you were looking at a painting?"
"I guess so."
"Then indeed, you must be a most relentless writer on the arts. I understand you used the police business phone to report the heinous deed, rather than police emergency."
"Yes."
"Why is that?"
"Why not? Nothing could be done at the moment. The girl was clearly dead. I'd rather leave the emergency line clear for someone who needed the police immediately, to stop a crime in progress or get someone to a hospital."
"Mr. Fletcher, people with stutters and stammers and high breathlessness call the police emergency number to report a cat in a tree. Did you look up the police business number in a book?"
"The operator gave it to me."
"I see. Were you ever a policeman yourself?"
"No."
"Just wondering. Something about your sophistication regarding bodies in the parlor. The conciseness of your answers. After a murder, usually it's only the policeman who wants to get to bed. Where was I?"
"I have no idea," Fletch said. "In the 19th century?
"No, I'm not in the 19th century, Mr. Fletcher. I'm in Boston, and I'm wondering what you're doing here."
"I'm here to do research. I want to try a biography of the Western artist Edgar Arthur Tharp, Jr. He was born and brought up here in Boston, you know, Inspector."
"I do know that."
The Tharp family papers are here. The Boston Museum has a great many of his works.
Have you ever been in Boston before?
No.
Do you know anyone here?
I don't think so.
Let's go over your arrival in Boston again, Mr. Fletcher. It makes such a marvelous story. This time, tell me the approximate times of everything. Again, I remind you that Grover will take it all down, and we're not supposed to correct him later, although I always do. Now, when did you land in Boston?
I was in the airport waiting for my luggage at 3:40. I set my watch by the airport clock.
What airlines? What flight number?
Transworld. I don't know the flight number. I went through customs. I got a taxi and came here. I got here about 5:30.
I understand about going through customs, but the airport is only 10 minutes from here.
You're asking me? I believe traffic control is also considered police business.
The representative of Boston Police said, "Ah, well, so of course it was 5 o'clock. Where in particular did he get stuck?"
"In some crazy tunnel with a dripping roof and chirruping fans."
"Ah, yes, the Callahan. I've sat in there myself. But at 5 o'clock, the traffic in there usually gets stuck going north, not south."
"I shaved and showered and changed my clothes. I unpacked. I left here, I would guess, a little after 6:30. I took a taxi to the restaurant."
"Which restaurant?"
"The Cafe Budapest."
"Now that's interesting. How did you know enough to go to such a fine restaurant your first night in town?"
"The man sitting next to me on the plane mentioned it."
"Do you remember his name?"
"He never mentioned it. We didn't talk much, just while we were having lunch. I think he said he was some kind of an engineer from some place I think called Wesley Hills."
"Wellesley Hills. In Boston we spell everything the long way, too. Did you have the cherry soup?"
"At the Budapest, yes.
I hear it's a great privilege. For those who can afford it."
I tried to walk home. It had seemed like a short ride in the taxi. I left the restaurant shortly after 8 and got here, I would say, just before 9:30. In the meantime, I got thoroughly lost.
Where? I mean, where did you get lost?
Fletch looked around the room before answering.
"If I knew that, would I have been lost?" "Answer the question, please. Describe to me where you went."
"God. A Sitco sign? A huge, gorgeous Sitco sign. Remarkable piece of art."
"There now, you see, that wasn't so difficult, was it? You turned left rather than right. That is, you went west rather than east. You went into Kenmore Square. What did you do then?"
"I asked to go for Beacon Street, and it was right there. I walked along it until I came to 152. It was a long walk."
"Yes, that was a long walk, especially after a Hungarian dinner. So you came into the apartment and went into the living room. Why did you go into the living room?"
"To turn off the lights."
"So you must have gone into the living room the first time you were in the apartment and turned on the lights."
"Sure, I looked around the apartment. I don't remember whether I left the lights on in the living room or not."
"Undoubtedly you did. Anyone as likely a murderer as you are is apt to do anything. Now, why were you in Rome?"
"I live there. Actually, I have a villa in Cagna, on the Italian Riviera."
"Then why didn't you fly from Genoa or Cannes?"
"I was in Rome anyway."
"Why?"
"Andy has an apartment there."
"Andy the girl? You've been living with Andy the girl?"
"Yes."
"How long?"
"A couple of months."
"And you met with Bartholomew Connors, Esquire, in Rome?"
"Who? Oh, no, I don't know Connors."
"You said this was his apartment."
"It is."
"Then how are you in it if you don't know Mr. Connors?"
"Home Swap. It's an international organization. I think their headquarters is in London. Connors takes my villa in Cagna for 3 months. I use his apartment in Boston. Cuts down on the use of money."
"You've never met?"
"We've never even corresponded. Everything, even the exchange of keys, was arranged through London."
"Well, I'm sure I'll catch up again with this world one day."
"Don't write that down, Grover."
"So, Mr. Fletcher, you say you don't know Bartholomew Connors at all, and you don't know Ruth Fryer either.
Who is she?"
"You answered that question so perfectly, I'm beginning to believe I'm talking to myself. Mr. Fletcher, Ruth Fryer is the young lady they've just taken out of your living room."
"Oh."
"Oh," he says, "Grover.
Inspector, I believe I have never seen that young lady before in my life."
"Taking your story as the word from John, That's St. John, Grover. When you discovered the body, didn't you wonder where the young lady's clothes were? Or are you so used to seeing gorgeous girls naked on the Riviera, you think they all come that way?
No, Fletch said, I did not wonder where her clothes were.
You came in here and looked at a painting instead. Inspector, you've got to understand there was a lot to wonder about at that moment. I was in a state of shock. I didn't know where the girl came from. Why should I wonder where her clothes went to?
They were in your bedroom, Mr. Fletcher, with the bodice torn.
Fletcher ran his eyes along a shelf of books.
I'm not sure I've ever heard the word bodice spoken before.
Of course, I've read it in 19th century English novels.
Would you like to hear my version of what happened here tonight?
No.
Let me run through it anyway. I can still get home in time for 2 o'clock feeding. You arrived at the airport, having left your true love in Rome, but also after having been confined to her company for 2 months, living in her apartment, the last few days of which have been sad days, seeing to her father's funeral.
Sort of funeral.
You escaped the dearly beloved with divine celerity, Mr. Fletcher. That's a nice alignment of words, Grover. Have you got them all?
Yes, Inspector.
In their proper order?
Yes, Inspector.
You came here and introduced yourself to this huge, impressive apartment. Your sense of freedom was joined by a sense of loneliness, which is a potently dangerous combination in the loins of any healthy young man. You shave and you shower, spruce yourself up, never thinking ill of yourself for a minute. Are you with my version of the story so far?
I can't wait to see how it comes out.
You take yourself out into the drizzle. Perhaps you do the obvious and stop in at the first singles bar you come to. You put forth your noticeable charm to the most attractive girl there, possibly a little under the drizzle from gin. By the way, Grover, we'll want to know what's in that girl's stomach. Entice her back here to your bedroom where she resists you for some reason of her own. She promised mother, or had forgotten to take her pills, or whatever it is young ladies say these days when they change their minds. You tear her clothes off her in the bedroom. Thoroughly frightened, she runs down the corridor to the living room. You catch up to her. She continues to resist you. Perhaps she is screaming, and you don't know how thick the walls are. You're in a new place. You left your fiancé this morning in Rome. Here's the classic case of adults in a room, and one of them isn't consenting. In frustration, in anger, in fear, in passionate rage, you pick up something or other and knock her over the head. To subdue her, to get her to stop screaming. Probably even you were surprised when she crumpled and sank to your feet.
Flynn rubbed one green eye with the palm of his huge hand.
Now, Mr. Fletcher, why isn't that the obvious truth?
Inspector, do you think it is the truth?
No, I don't.
He pressed the palms of both hands against his eyes.
At least not at the moment, he said. If you'd been drinking, yes, I'd believe it in a moment. If you were less attractive, I'd believe it. What else do these girls hang around for if it's not the Peter Fletchers of the world? If you were less self-possessed, I'd believe it. It's my guess it would take less cool to get rid of a resisting girl than go through an initial police questioning for murder. Never can tell, though. We all have our moments. If you hadn't called the police business phone, I'd be quicker to believe in your being in an impassioned, uncontrolled state. No, I don't believe it either.
Grover said, "You mean we're not arresting him, Inspector?"